Jen, how is Mexico?
Mexico has been great for me. I've been playing volleyball every day. It's been wonderful. But my poor husband, in the first day we were here, we were playing in a volleyball tournament, and he landed in like a hole, and his toe went under his foot, and like his whole body weight went on top of the toe. So I've been wheeling him around in a wheelchair for a week. And, but he's doing okay.
Oh no.
I know, it's like so sad, but we made the best
Jen,
of it.
You should, just to be safe, you should probably get him one of those collars so he can't scratch himself, you know, like one of those kind of lampshade collars for Joe. Plus I think that'd be adorable, seeing Joe in a wheelchair with a lampshade collar.
That would be super cute, but I don't think scratching is the problem here.
No.
Yeah,
okay.
Like,
you want to take that risk. That's on you.
Foot. Yeah.
So is he going to be able to walk out of Mexico? Is he going to have to wheel out of Mexico?
Yeah. So I just rented the wheelchair for the whole week. So at this point we're being careful. So,
And you know, you can get all kind of drugs in Mexico, right? I mean, legally, over the counter shit.
That's actually what the staff told me.
Yeah. Because I'm a little bit of a bad boy. When I was in Mexico last year, I got 3 jars of antibiotics in case the grid ever goes down. Come to my house. I have antibiotics. But so I could have apparently got amphetamines and painkillers and things. It didn't even occur to me till later.
So you're a narc, a drug runner, and a prepper now.
Well, yes. I've always been one of those things. That's, yes, that's sure. I'm all those things. I'm working on my merit badges. The heat and merit badges are coming to fruition.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Puerto Vallarta, I am Jen Briney.
And we're not wrong on this edition of the program. We're going to be talking about the relationship between Texas and Mexico. Title 42 expiring and creating what the Department of Homeland Security says will be the largest migration since World War II across the southern border over the next few weeks. And another number, the 14th Amendment. Can it indeed be constitutionally enshrined, and has it always been, that the president doesn't have to go to Congress for the debt ceiling? Indeed, he or she can raise it no matter what. That is allegedly, reportedly, on the mind of Joseph Robinette Biden Jr. and his team as they negotiate the debt ceiling with Congress currently. All that plus your emails. Jen, we have had a Jen-sized hole in our lives for the last week. We have not actually spoken in 2 weeks because we ran the live show. Thank you to everybody for coming out to that and for enjoying that, but it is good to have you back in our lives.
I've missed you guys too, for sure. I wish you were in Mexico with me. I'm pretty happy to be on vacation, but yeah, it's I miss you guys.
Jen, eventually my goal is for all of us to have RVs and create a mobile commune that we just drive around the world podcasting.
I'm in. It sounds really fun to me. I've already been RV shopping. I'm halfway there.
Really? Okay.
I'm really glad that you were able to take a vacation from your back-breaking schedule of podcasting and playing volleyball 4 times a week to not podcasting and playing volleyball 5 times a week.
Yeah. That is exactly what I did.
Well, let's go ahead and get back to the grindstone. Enough of you slacking off, Jen. It's about time you earned an honest buck. So let's talk Title 42 this Thursday. That will expire. So the question is, the hell is Title 42? Well, I'll tell you. It's a section of the United States health law that has been used during the COVID-19 pandemic to quickly expel migrants at the border, including some seeking asylum. This is when it was put in place over the COVID-19 pandemic in an effort to prevent the spread of the virus. It was, of course, done by the Trump administration, who probably would have loved to have that authority anyway, but we move on. The policy was put in place during Trump and has been continued under Biden. Critics say that Title 42 being used for immigration enforcement denies migrants their rights to seek asylum. It also allows for the rapid expulsion of individuals without the usual due process involved in the immigration proceedings. The expiration, which has been delayed several times by the Biden administration, is the target of a sweeping immigration bill from House Republicans who want to pass their bill the same day that Title 42 expires. If indeed the Republicans in the House can come together, it will be the second time that this rowdy group who couldn't agree on a speaker has become the annoying group that sends unpassable legislation to the Senate. Speaking of the Senate, by the way, Senator Tom Tillis and Senator Kyrsten Sinema are reportedly working on their own immigration legislation. They have a bit of a track record. They were the leaders of getting the gun legislation that passed during the last Congress. At a conference last weekend, Sinema told the crowd that immigration remains a problem in the United States because both parties profit from it. So we begin with you, Jen, our resident Mexican. Should Title 42 be allowed to expire?
Yes, it was an emergency measure. I have long been against letting emergency measures last forever. I mean, we're still under emergency powers in like the Korean War. Like, we just never let these emergencies expire. So considering even the World Health Organization is saying that COVID is over, it's time for all of it to expire. That said, though,
wait, Jen, but you're in favor of keeping the Patriot Act in case that Saddam Hussein guy comes back, right? Because like, if he comes back, you're going to be glad we got that Patriot Act still going full strong.
Somehow Saddam has returned.
So I know you're making a joke here, but there is a difference in that the Patriot Act was a law and this COVID stuff was not. So, you know, it was, but there was always an expiration date on all of it. Like, I read the CARES Act and there was always a until the end of the emergency situation in that law. And so now that the emergency is over in U.S. law and internationally, it has to expire. But that doesn't mean that we should allow anyone and everyone to claim that they're an asylum seeker and just stay here forever. And I will reiterate that I've watched a lot of hearings about this, although not recently. I'd say the last time I looked into this was probably like a year or two ago. But what we were being told is the reason that we have people coming and staying for so long, it's not necessarily that they're showing up that is the problem. It's that it's too long for us to process them. So they come into the United States, they hang out for like 5 years. And then by that time, they either don't show up to their hearing or they're already like assimilated here. It's a big old mess. We need more judges. And Congress has been told this over and over again for years. We need more judges. You could put them down in El Paso or all these border towns and just process these claims immediately. Decide who's a migrant that gets an asylum. You know, I don't know how that works. When you get asylum, like, do you get a green card? Like, I don't know what you get, but you can have judges down there if you're willing to pay for them and they could adjudicate this stuff right away. And then we would know whether or not they get to stay. That doesn't seem to be in anyone's plans. And so I just need to put that out there once again, that that's what Congress is being told. And yet it doesn't seem to be in the conversation about this.
Heaton, we will start with Title 42.
I agree with everything Jen just said. I think that Biden is right to let an emergency measure that is specifically attached to a pandemic subside.
So I believe he's had two chances to do this before and he has extended it. Uh-huh. Was that?
And he's right to now quit extending it. So recently Biden said that the pandemic is over, meaning that the emergency powers granted to the administration by the pandemic are also over. It would be very curious for him to say the pandemic is over. I am no longer executing emergency powers, except for this one power, because we've got too many immigrants. That would be, I am not for misusing laws in order to do the expedient thing. If the point of the law was clearly an exceptional situation involving a public health crisis and the public health crisis has been averted, then there's no reason for that to remain on the books. To Jen's point, judges make a ton of sense to me. It sounds like we've got a spigot that's too small and we need to get a bigger spigot in terms of just being able to process who we let in. That doesn't even necessarily mean that we change the amount of immigrants coming in. It just means that our ability to process it works so that rather than having a glut, we're able to bring them in. But then I would add to that, I'm curious to see what Sinema and Tom Tillis come up with, because we've been I hesitate to say we've been trying to get immigration reform since the 2000s, because that would imply that we've actually been trying to get immigration reform since the 2000s.
That was the last big push. And that, if you actually look at the coalition of the Republican Party, where things probably you can trace a lot of what became MAGA, the MAGA coalition, was about the last big immigration push that would have created some level of amnesty.
Right. And while I'm not in the habit of complimenting the Bush administration, I think that the Bush administration was on the right when it came to immigration reform. He was going to try to figure out ways to smooth that process, get more seasonal workers coming in. He was pro-immigrant. It seems to me that the Republicans have kind of two mindsets on immigration. Group one wants immigration, but they want it merit-based, and then they want it to be very legal. Group two is xenophobic. And so we're trying to make an immigration reform where these two poles are happening within the Republican Party. The Democratic Party, I think, is pro-immigration, but more on the it should be humane than whether or not it's coming through chain migration and families or whether it's coming through merit-based stuff. But it seems to me that there's some wiggle room there. The other thing that the Republicans have right now that I think is a germane point is that the asylum seekers specifically are not evenly distributed throughout the country. They are collecting along the southern border. I like just shooting from the hip here. I would go, hey, just every state, say how many asylum seekers you would like to host, and we'll make that happen. Because right now, I think that is a legitimate thing. If the distribution is overwhelming the local resources of El Paso and other places like that, there ought to be some mechanism to try to more distribute that pressure going on. And so there are ways that I think states could proactively do that.
Okay, hold on. I've just gotten my text message from Vermont. Zero. My name is Paul. No, hold on. I'm reading it now. My name is Paul, and this is between y'all, apparently, is the official statement from Vermont.
You know, and that is, I think, the Republican caricature of the blue states, that they want it. They like the idea of immigration so long as it doesn't actually affect them. But I think that there's probably plenty of people in Vermont and California and other blue states that would welcome.
Sure. I mean, I'm not.
California, first of all, like, is a border state, so they are dealing with this. But one of the things that did make it through my vacation, you know, wall is that the mayor of Chicago sent a letter to Greg Abbott of Texas, basically being like, stop sending us your migrants. We have 8,000 and it's too many. So letters like that don't really help the blue states look any better, where Greg Abbott wrote back,
okay, blue states, get your shit together. Quit being hypocrites, blue states.
Well, he's obviously doing this to be a dick. Like, the way that Abbott is sending people is not cool. Like, he's not working with the other states. But at the same time, his point in his letter back, I think, was a good one, because he was like, listen, we have 13,000 people coming over the border every day. Now, do I trust his numbers? Like, I don't know. But if that is the truth,
even Homeland Security has said that the number that is coming through is around that level.
Okay. So if that's the truth, and you have a state saying, if you have a city that's saying 8,000 is too many for us, and there's 13,000 a day, like, there is kind of some, you know, you kind of have to sit back and look at that and be like, okay, like, blue states, like, maybe we should pay more attention to this, because that is an enormous crush. And if Chicago can't handle 8,000, like, why are we expecting these border towns to handle so much more than that? They kind of have a point. I hate defending Greg Abbott, but he kind of has a point.
No. That is a fair point. And that's why I reiterate, I think that a good starting position right now would be, let's just go around every major city and state. How many asylum seekers can you take? And when the number comes back and it's like, in sum total, we can get 24,000 this year. Okay, that's what we're going to be letting in through the border then. We're literally going to figure out how many people can come in based on asylum.
So we will deny asylum claims if it hits a hard cap.
If we are accepting the premise that there is actually a saturation point to asylum seekers, then whatever that saturation point is ought to be it. I'm for yay more people, right?
That is a fairly conservative position to say that we would deny asylum seekers if it hit a certain cap.
Okay. I guess then the other position would be we just let them pool in El Paso and get $13,000 a day.
This is the reason why right now, and I can appreciate your philosophical idea of like, okay, well, there is a strain of conservative thought that is merit-based. There's a strain of conservative thought that is xenophobia. There is a reality that exists on our southern border that is an absolute dystopic nightmare. Like the fact that it has become the focal point for entry into the United States for migration or otherwise, that we are working within loopholes upon loopholes upon loopholes that are sending 12-year-olds unaccompanied across the border with a note saying, please talk to this person that we know through a Homeland Security that the people that they are going to, we have no sense of whether or not they're actually family, and that it is being used as essentially child trafficking. Like
that's where the whole kids in cages thing came from, right?
Well, because initially it was okay. The parent comes over with the child. Mm-hmm. We're going to separate the parent and the child because this is an illegal act, and they will be expelled. What happens past that? Okay, that's bad, terrible. Let's stop doing that. Then, okay, we won't let the adult in, we will let the child in for whom says that they have somebody legally in America. And if they have a note with them saying, please call this person, that's really all they need. And there has been leaked video of the organizations that handle this with the powers that be saying, we need to clear these faster. Like, we need to just get these kids out of our...
Okay,
out of
all our, right, out hold on. I'm amending the Heaton plan. Can you please call Kristen Sinema and Tom Tillis? Here's what we're going to... Rather than having everybody pass a hat around saying how many asylum seekers they can take...
Yes.
Once you're on the United States side, you've been granted asylum, we've got a bunch of buses, and we just distribute people based on state population. How about that?
Okay. I think... We take this idea that has happened with all these red state governors, like DeSantis and Abbott. We just take it to the next level. Congratulations. Get on a plane. We're sending you to Spain. We're sending you to England. We're sending you to Japan. We just say, go ahead. We're sending you to another country altogether.
I am curious how other countries are handling stuff like this. Like in Europe, I don't think they just let you stay. There's also like, I question our asylum policies. Like, again, I don't really know much, but who are these people that are qualifying for asylum? How is there this many people that are in such dire straits that they can never go home? Like, I just don't understand how we're hitting these numbers. And are these people, after they get their court dates, being sent home? Or are they being allowed to stay? Like, is this a permanent problem? I think there's a lot of we don't know in that too. Like, I don't know how many of these people are actually getting deported and how many actually get to stay. In which case, like, if we're not actually keeping a lot of these people and we do have a lot of judges at the border, like, that kind of is Title 42. You just, like, let them come in and get their day in court. But if we are allowing most of these people in, then that becomes the problem, in which we need to find the buses or the planes and places for them to live and ways for them to get green cards and all of that. Like, I feel like I don't have the information to judge which problem this is. Is it we need to deport these people faster, or is it we need to assimilate them faster? Like, what is actually happening? I don't know.
So I can weigh in on a couple of these things. The European Union is very interesting when it comes to immigration, because the European Union, the individual states maintain sovereignty, but they're doing so within a collective passport regime. So that is to say, imagine that every state in the United States has its own internal immigration norms of how I become a citizen and how I'm offered asylum. But if you get over the border of the United States, no one's checking your passports anywhere in it. So theoretically, if Texas is like, come on in, everybody, I can make a beeline from Texas to Minnesota. That was one of the big, whether it was warranted or not, that was one of the big concerns that Britain had with Brexit, was that the entitlement programs in the United Kingdom would be so appealing that if people entered through Greece, they would just come by train or boat to the UK. Again, I don't know whether those numbers bore out or not, but that was the philosophical concern. In regards to the United States, I think it's changed quite a lot from administration to administration, whether they're being deported or quote unquote catched and released. So President Obama had been the administration that had the most deportations to date in American history. But
the deporter in chief,
he
was nicknamed by his own party.
However, if you look at how the Bush administration was handling it, what the Bush administration did was just catch and release. So they, if you came over the border, and you were illegally detained, they would just drive you back over the border and release you. So they weren't actually going through the paperwork of all of that. Benefit being, if you got caught and released, you could just come back. There's no, your name's not on file as having violated those things. You haven't gone through a court process. The Obama administration wanted to go through the court process, so they relied more heavily on deportations. I believe that Trump did more deportations than Obama, but I could be wrong about that. Insofar as the assimilation, I have no idea as well, Jen, as to what the percentage of, off the top of my head, of say worker based versus asylum versus chain based. I'm not really sure.
Yeah, I feel like this has been such a discussion for so long, and yet all of that is murky. So it's really hard for us Americans to know what we would even suggest to do, when I feel like none of this has really been explained to us. And again, I've watched a bunch of hearings, and I still don't quite understand what the numbers are there, like how many get to stay, how many get deported, like what the policies are. Like, it's hard to debate our policy when we don't know what it is.
So noting that, I will then turn our attention to our resident, I was going to use a Game of Thrones metaphor, but the guy that understands the guts of politics. Justin, is Kyrsten Sinema correct? Is this a wedge issue that Congress is intentionally keeping open in order to drive politics?
100%. She is dead right on it. It is exactly like abortion. It is exactly like a bunch of issues that are too predictable in their fundraising and in their agitating the voting bases that they need to go out and vote, that they ever want to make it go away. They want to make a thing happen. They want to say, I stood up and did a thing. They want to offer the patina of a solution, but I don't believe that they desperately want to. As Jen said, not only is this border problem been a problem forever, but from my perspective, it's different than it has been, in that, you know, I was used to a very unique immigration process in Florida while I was growing up, because we had wet foot, dry foot. So that meant if you risked your life coming from Cuba, oftentimes on homemade flotillas, and survived that trip and were able to make it to Florida, you were now welcomed into the country. It was immigration by survivor challenge. And it was super weird, but it was what happened. Meanwhile, if you were from Haiti or if you were from the Dominican Republic, two places that oftentimes have had tragedy befall them, specifically Haiti, if you got caught after you came, you could get on a flight and come here, and you could get kicked out because we did not have wet foot, dry foot for Haiti. The thing that changed my mind about the border was a thing that happened last year, where one of the gigantic migrant surges were Haitians. Almost entirely Haitians, people that were coming from Haiti through Central America and walking, because getting to the southern border was a safer thing for them to do, to assimilate into America, to come into America, than getting on a boat or getting on or some means to go from the relatively shorter hop to Florida. But that means that something is uniquely broken at the southern border, if it is worth that level of sacrifice for those people, in my mind. And so if that's the case, then I do think something needs to happen at the southern border. And I have never really been a big wall guy. I've always thought that it's performance art in the desert. I am more on the side of Jen's issue, that maybe we need a wall of judges that are
a group of people in smocks holding hands around the border.
We just need a judge that processes asylum claims like an auctioneer, and runs through people coming through, but at least gives anybody who's thinking about coming to America a general sense of what is going on. Because if you look at the numbers that are coming, I believe that the general sense for them, And a lot of these people are being taken advantage of by coyotes who are lying to them, who are telling them things that are not true. But there is enough of a facts on the ground situation that you got a lot of people coming from a lot of different places that never were the normal people that came through the southern border, which was by and large Mexican Central Americans. But you're seeing a lot of South Americans, a lot of Caribbeans. Like it's weird. Something is very, very weird at the border. And I agree with Kyrsten Sinema that there is a reason why it has been allowed to get this weird, because nobody wants to fix this that has money and power.
Well, and to bring up something that we've mentioned on the program before, a good example of the kind of inherent political cynicism going on here is the Dreamers. Remember them? Remember the evil, yes, racist Trump administration that wasn't doing anything about the Dream? Why wasn't, like, the Democrats had the House and the Senate at the beginning of the Biden administration? Why didn't they just fix this? Because it's a nice card to have in your back pocket. They're a convenient group of people that you can kind of shake and say racism whenever a Republican's in power again. And until then, we'll just keep them in limbo. Could have been solved.
It's been odd about the Democrats because it's like they don't even want to talk about this issue. It's like they're not for or against it. They're just silent on it and have been for so long. Just politically, I don't know what they're doing.
Except when Trump was there, right?
Yeah. But on this one, they're just quiet. And, you know, Justin, it's interesting. You just said to me, like, there's something weird, like all these people, why are they coming? But our own rhetoric is kind of encouraging that, isn't it? Like, especially on the Republican side, where they keep saying our border is wide open and there's no one policing it and we need a wall. Like, the more they say that, the more people from other countries will be like, oh, the border's wide open. Like, let's go before they shut it down.
I like this idea that Trump negged immigrants coming over here.
Yeah,
like, the president of the United States negged the global population.
No, I'm not saying Trump. I'm saying, like, the Republicans in Congress right now during the Biden administration are saying, well, Biden's in charge, which means the border's wide open. And now we have, like, another surge. And the way they're talking about Title 42, like, oh, it's about to open wide up. Like, they're about to start handing out candy bars to everyone who makes it over the border. Like, they're making it sound like we're welcoming people in a way that I don't think we actually are.
I would wonder what the media saturation of Fox News is in the caravans. Like, are they all sitting down and watching Hannity?
I'm in Mexico right now. Like, you can access CNN and, like, all that stuff. Like, it's here. So, and this rhetoric has been going on for a while.
Sure. Yeah. Even then, like CNN.com, I mean, I was being a little glib before with the Hannity thing, but even like American media, cause I would wonder, and my suspicion is that there are local messages that are probably informed on some level by, things that happen in American politics, but these are truths that lie in motivations deeper than just our political tennis match of firing these accusations back and forth.
No, I agree with that. The only thing I'm trying to say is, like, if you're trying to make this decision and then you're hearing from the country you're going to that the border is wide open, I do think it has an effect.
And
people think the border is open.
My only question is, I wonder exactly how much they're hearing that. But yeah, I would agree with you. That certainly was an argument from the Republican side that the reason why there were larger surges was because of Biden's rhetoric during the 2020 campaign. So certainly turnabout would be fair play there.
I actually don't know what the Democratic position is on this. Like I said, I think the Republican position is you've got the law and order merit-based Republicans. So kind of your Mitt Romney types who are like, immigration's good if they obey the law and they ought to be coming here for a job. And then you've got your bigots. And xenophobes. I think Trump was very much an immigration restrictionist, and I think he was, you know, palling around on the xenophobic impulse to do that. With the Democrats, I don't feel like there's a coherent message. Like, I feel like it's just don't be mean, and it's just kind of a temperamental response. I could be wrong about this, and I'll solicit some listener feedback on this. But like Bernie Sanders for the longest time was an immigration restrictionist. He wasn't an open borders guy.
He was a unionist.
Because he's a unionist.
Yes.
The labor tended to be anti-immigrant,
yes,
in American history. But I, like with Pelosi and stuff, I don't really know what her immigration goal would have been. The libertarians want to have basically open borders minus entitlements. They like the idea of just free labor market moving back and forth. But with the Democrats, I don't actually know kind of what the goal would be other than not being mean.
I don't either. And I think that's a problem. In all those hearings I watched, I could not give you a coherent strategy that's coming out of the Democrats, it's like they're silent on it. It's strange to me.
And I think it's because they've never wanted, they've found it to be a very, very specific and advantageous cudgel when it was concentration camps and kids in cages. This was a visceral telegenic issue that they could tag Trump on. Here's a crying child who has come from nothing and is seeking the American dream. It was, for Democrats, a very animated and visceral example of cruelty from a man in which cruelty was the point, as we heard so many times. This, now that they own it, is something that they have no idea what to do with. Like, and there's a reason why they have dithered on Title 42 for a while. Like, they have kind of kicked the can down the road. They have said sent Kamala Harris. They made her eat the poop sandwich of going down to the Central American Triangle states and saying, please do not come, which is exactly the opposite of what they were saying during the campaign when they were fighting for humanity at the border. This is a real pickle for them, and they don't know how to own it. They are afraid that they are going to be looked at as hypocrites because they hammered Trump so hard on it. And I think they are only now, the Biden administration is only now starting to look at this as an active problem that could hurt them in 2020, which is the only reason why they are going to start to put any kind of political efficacy toward it, is because now they worry that this is something that could be a hangover in 2020.
Just to, defend the Democrats a little bit, during the Trump administration, their policy was to separate children from their parents, which is terrifying and horrible. And I do think that this policy, at least in that regard, has changed. Like, they've brought back the family detention so they at least keep them together. So there is that. I mean, you're absolutely right that, like, the big picture of it, they're not trying to solve it at all. But again, the one message that came through to me loud and clear from the officials is more judges, more judges, more judges. And I feel like it makes so much sense that I don't understand why that is not the first part of their platform. They've heard it over and over again in the hearings. It is so obvious. I don't understand why they're not at least starting there. And they're not. Like, I don't understand them.
What we don't know are the details right now on either the Republican position, which they're going to see whether or not they can get their act together to pass on Thursday, or what has been the slow moving, but possibly more realistic Tillis Sinema plan.
Yeah, and I think there could be some hope there, because I think I saw Sinema in those hearings, and as an Arizona senator, like, she might actually want to solve this one, especially since she's been, you know, so hated lately. Like, it would be cool for her to get a win in a way that, like, actually helps the country. So I'd be really curious to see what those two put together, because you know, you have a really, really conservative guy in Tillis, and you have a pretty conservative Democrat in Sinema. But I actually think that that's a combo that could work in this Congress. So
I think you're 100% right, because the compromise position is going to be someone that's more eclectic, right? So yeah. when we're dealing with identity questions in politics, those are very difficult to compromise on. What is the United States? How do we feel about gay people? Like, it's questions like that that are values based and ideological are very difficult to compromise on. But things that are a bit more quotidian, and I would put immigration in that camp, you can absolutely do compromise on. We could theoretically come up with a bill where we go, all right, we're going to increase immigration, but we're going to increase it through merit based. We're going to have more judges, but at the same time, we're going to have more border patrols as well, or something like that. There's a way for everybody to get three quarters of what they want and arrive at a workable solution.
Can I give you a very cynical projection of how this winds up playing out?
Sure.
Sinema and Tillis come up with a thing, and it'll be looked at as fairly reasonable, and Chuck Schumer will not let it be discussed on the floor because he wants her out and he wants Gallego in.
Chuck Schumer will do one better. Chuck Schumer will look at it and go, this is 98% what we want, but we're going to hold out for the 100% thing that we will never get in order to throw this lady under the bus. Like, the Democrats could have legalized pot last time. They didn't do it. Schumer went, no, because it's not quite where we want it to be. But like could have been legalized federally. And he went, nah.
I think that take all the theories out of it and whether or not Republicans or Democrats are good and just look at it in the office politics perspective of who likes who. There is a frenemy relationship right now that we don't know which way it's going to tilt between Sinema and Schumer. Schumer was happy that Sinema continues to caucus with the Democrats as an independent. But do I think that Schumer, a dyed in the wool, absolute true blue Dem, would rather somebody with a D next to their name than an I next to their name be in his posse in the Senate? Yeah. And I do think that the DNC hates Sinema. They want Gallego in. They do not in any way want to make her look like the adult in the room standing next to Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake, who is likely going to run on the Republican side. And that's really Sinema's only shot to win that three-way race, is lean on incumbency and say, hey, look, this is what I got done. I got this stuff on the border done. Carrie Lake would never do that. Ruben Gallego would fight over something dumb and not actually make this deal. I made the deal. And so if you want to stop her, you don't let her make the deal.
Yeah. And if you want some legislative cynicism, I don't know which, you know, posse this would come from, but what I kind of fear in this is that whatever comes out of it just ends up being a way to funnel money to all of the companies that want to make a border wall. They keep talking about an electronic border wall, which means drones and all kinds of expensive toys. They keep talking about like fentanyl trafficking. So I think this could just end up another way to fund massive, expensive, largely ineffective law enforcement capabilities, which funnel money to the Northrops and the Raytheons and the, you know, the same damn companies that keep getting money to do security theater for us. That is one thing that I'd be worried about any bill that comes out of this Congress.
My personal Obi-Wan Kenobi, the great late PJ O'Rourke, said that a border wall is a $16 billion subsidy to Mexican ladder companies. And I think he's accurate about that, based on all of the viral videos I've seen of just that happening.
Well, that's why they think it's so brilliant to have drones and like automate, you know, those like automated dogs. Those are the types of things they want to put on the border. Cause like, just like you said, like, is a fence going to do it? No. So how about all these other toys? Like I don't know if they actually want to solve the immigration problem or if they just want to funnel money to the same companies that have been funding their campaigns.
I think if there is any actual policy to be settled on, that is going to be the price you pay.
Yeah.
Inflate the military industrial complex and maybe we'll let you have sane policy.
Yeah. Pretty much.
That sounds like the monkey's paw bargain we're dealing with in our country right now. Of like, how do we solve the debt? I just asked the fucking the defense contractors what they want to do. Maybe we could get something here.
Yeah, we'll build you a hot air balloon and you can use it. We'll just send money up to the hot air balloon every 12 hours. And if you let us have more judges on the border. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. That's our hot air balloon. And you can send us money anytime you want. Just head on over to patreon.com/we're not wrong. On the march to 900, we have summited 800. We are now to 9. We're battling for 9. And at that point, friends, there's only 100 people left until we get to 1,000. We will do it this year. Will you be a part of it? Well, that's a question you have to ask the man in the mirror. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. You know, you get something for your money. You get a bonus topic. We talk about two of them on the free show, one of them on the Patreon show. And this week it is all about the Writers Guild of America strike and whether or not they should fear artificial intelligence, which is one of the things that they are now negotiating about with the studios. Should they fear AI and porn? Often together are two topics that get talked about a lot on the Patreon, and we will continue that strike. So, or that, Freudian slip, that streak, talking about the strike on our Patreon episode. The Biden administration is cautiously considering the possibility of using the 14th Amendment as a mechanism to avoid breaching the debt ceiling, a situation that could lead to a financial crisis. This amendment contains language stating that the public debt, quote, shall not be questioned, which could potentially be interpreted to allow the president to continue issuing debt unilaterally. However, there are concerns about the legal standing of this approach and the potential financial and political repercussions that it could bring. While Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has warned that the United States could breach the debt limit by early June, leading to severe economic consequences, she also stated that using the 14th Amendment could trigger a constitutional crisis. Biden himself has expressed hesitance about this option, indicating that he hasn't decided on using it just yet. Now, if Biden were to invoke the 14th Amendment, it could spark litigation. And at the same time, debates about the debt ceiling are becoming more frequent. And some people who've previously rejected the idea of using the 14th Amendment are now embracing it. Legal scholars remain divided on the issue as the Constitution under Article 1 gives Congress the power to pay debts and borrow money, and using the 14th Amendment could be seen as undermining this constitutional provision. Yellen, who determines such things, has said that the drop-dead date for us to raise the debt ceiling or else we run out of money is somewhere between the 1st and 14th of June, meaning we are on the clock. Andrew Heaton, This sounds like the kind of plan that gets yelled really, really loud at a bar in Capitol Hill at like 1 o'clock in the morning with a bunch of fired up drunk nerds. Do you believe the American president has the authority to pay the nation's debts without Congress?
No, I do not think that. I don't think Joe Biden thinks that either. My hope is that what Biden is doing is basically airing this possibility as a negotiation tactic with House Republicans. That is my hope, is that this is a way of getting them to get their house in order and arrive at a more realistic conclusion sooner rather than later. But the short answer is no. I'm very much in agreement with Janet Yellen on this. And Janet Yellen's right on two counts. One, it would be disastrous if we breach the debt ceiling. The reason that would be disastrous is we would have defaulted for the first time in American history on the debt. And when we do that, we still owe the debt. We still have to pay everybody that we owe money to. But what happens is now people either don't want to buy the bonds, meaning that we can't buy stuff on deficit anymore, which would be crippling because we'd have to drop all of or a significant amount of federal programs or cut into Social Security and so on and so forth. Or alternately, more likely, our creditors go, well, we're only going to borrow money from you if you raise the interest because we just don't trust you anymore. So then we're paying more and more on interest rather than we are in terms of the actual federal program. So rather than spending money on bridges or Medicaid or Medicare, we're spending money
on hot air balloons.
We're spending more money on paying the interest itself, right? So we don't want to default on debt. There's no situation in which that's going to be good. She's absolutely right on that. I think that she's absolutely right as well that it would invoke a constitutional crisis were the Biden administration to play this 14th Amendment card. The 14th Amendment argument is saying that I think it's Article 4 of the 14th Amendment or Provision 4 of the 14th Amendment that is basically a Civil War amendment saying that Southern states can't go, we're not going to pay any debt incurred for the Civil War because we lost. That's my read on it. Noting that you don't interpret jurisprudence based on intention, you interpret it based on the letter of the law. I think it's a very long walk to get from there to the president can act unilaterally to bypass Congress in the event that the debt is going to hit the fan. In order for that to work, you also have to assume that the president has the ability to abrogate the Constitution in order to defend the Constitution, which I think is a pretty big jump of logic to say that the president can bypass the lawful duties enshrined in Congress by the Constitution. He can bypass that in order to protect a more obscure reading of the Constitution. So I don't think it would hold up in court. I think if that happens, the following would occur. It would invoke a constitutional crisis. There would be fears that the presidency had usurped a constitutional prerogative of Congress, which would be correct. That might spook markets. What would, I think, even more spook markets is the fact that the courts would almost certainly strike it down, which means that if I'm a bond buyer, I'm going to demand higher interest in order to compensate me for the fact that this is probably going to get struck down in 6 months anyway, so I want to get in and get out. And then it would be struck down, at which point we will have made the whole situation worse.
Gotten back to this point no matter what.
Yeah. So I think it's a bad idea. I am hoping that this is just a bluffing technique. I do not, unfortunately, I don't see a way around Congress having to do its job. There doesn't seem to be a method in our system where we can just make Congress a ceremonial argumentative body that doesn't actually do stuff. It ultimately is going to have to do this. And there's really no way around Congress just doing its job.
This goes back to the problem, which is that the Republicans have the Biden administration's strategy with this was looked at the absolute shit show that was the Republican search for a speaker, say, hey, you guys, you want to figure out a debt ceiling solution? Go nuts. Biden's number one thing was, show me your plan, I'll show you mine. That was literally his talking point, because he bet that they would not be able to come together on anything. Well, they did. And so now, that is the only plan that is there. It is DOA in the Senate. It has no shot there. It essentially guts most of Biden's legislative wins over the last...
It undoes the climate change bill. It undoes some of the infrastructure bill.
Which, by the way, I love the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act is now just being referred to as the climate change bill, because that's what it was to begin with. It had nothing to do with inflation at all. It was literally just a airbrush job that they put on top of it.
It was a bumper sticker to hand Joe Manchin to vote for it.
Yes.
So that he could go on CNN and say, it's an anti-inflation. We're not spending, we're investing.
Exactly.
We're investing in limiting inflation.
But anyway, so it would gut a lot of that. It's not going to happen, but Kevin McCarthy's solution was to say, hey, look, you said, give you a plan. Here's our plan. Now meet us in the middle on it, which Biden will never do. So, you know, the clock's ticking. It is May 9th as we talk.
Biden already has. Here's the thing. This all started. This whole debt ceiling brinksmanship started in 2012. And Biden was the vice president. Obama was the president. And the Republicans, in a way, kind of won, because they got the Budget Control Act out of that, which was such an irresponsible bill. The whole idea was we're going to raise the debt ceiling, and we're going to do something so irresponsible that everyone will have to come back to the negotiation table. And what it did was the sequester. Remember that? For years, just like these across-the-board cuts, and they were discretionary and military. Everybody hated them. And they ended up going into effect because Congress didn't do their job. But the point is that in the past, the Republicans, instead of Obama, Biden, back then, they said, we're never going to negotiate over the debt ceiling. This is stupid. We're not doing it. And then they did it. And so I think the Republicans are looking back on that recent history when this man was in the administration going, you have folded once before. We think you're going to do it again. So this is all coming back to haunt us. Now, when I look at this 14th Amendment thing, I think Andrew is absolutely right that it would be terrible consequences of it. But at the same time, my crystal ball, if they actually went down that road, looks a little bit different, because if you look at the wording of the Constitution, the debt ceiling itself could be the thing that is unconstitutional. And I am irritated with the Democrats that after all of this bullshit that happened during Obama-Biden, that they didn't just raise the debt ceiling indefinitely, because they had the power to do it. We didn't have to do any of this ever again.
We're scrapped the debt ceiling. It doesn't seem to have any effect on actually forcing any type of fiscal prudence, given that it's ineffective in doing so. Why are we having it? All it does is risk us defaulting every year or every 2 years.
And that is what the Democrats have said. That is what they knew. And when they had the power, they didn't do it. So I'm just looking at history repeating itself. And right now, I mean, I've thought it's horrible of the Republicans since the beginning. I think it's accurate when people say they are holding our country hostage so that they can get the cuts that they want. I think that's exactly what they're doing, and it's cynical and it shouldn't be allowed. I think there are people in the Republican Party that know that. I think that people that are actually fiscally conservative that don't just use that as a slogan.
I think that's what they're saying. I think that's their...
They're in lockstep right now.
No. Yeah, I agree. I think that that's they're like, yes, that's a feature, not a bug. Their pitch is that we are at the precipice of absolute fiscal apocalypse because of this debt. There needs to be a reversal in how we spend and the explosive nature of our debt. So yes, we are getting to a dire point right now, but we need to do this if you think this is dire, it's not going to be near as dire as when some of the consequences of our gigantic debt comes back and revisits us.
And in that regard,
well, I mean, if they were being honest about being worried about this debt, there's a lot of things that they would do differently. First of all, playing games with the debt ceiling, as Andrew said, just makes us pay more interest. So financially, this is a stupid idea. So they're not actually worried about the debt. And I don't think they ever have been, based on their behavior of when they are in power, constantly raising military expenditures, getting us into new wars. Like, they don't care about the debt. I don't buy that for a second. So they are using this as a hostage-taking opportunity. I don't think that they appreciate the consequences as much, because the people that are really into this are the crazy, less intelligent wing of the party. Where I do have some hope is I do know that if there were a handful of saner Republicans, we only need about five, there is a way that they could get around Kevin McCarthy. It's called a discharge position. It essentially allows the majority in the House to get a bill to the floor without the speaker wanting to do it. We would need five Republicans to join with the Democrats to do this. That is a possible way out of this. But if anyone in the Republican Party is actually fiscally responsible and isn't completely full of shit, this debt ceiling thing needs to stop. And so I think it's going to really show the American people who they are. But unfortunately, it seems to me right now that the Republicans seem to be going down the road of wanting their party to be completely insane. And this is the first time that I've actually been worried that we are going to go through this debt ceiling crisis. And it's only going to make the world move away from the dollar faster. There's going to be consequences to it, but these people don't seem to care. And for the last 10 years, I've watched them go crazier and crazier. And we keep thinking that saner heads will prevail. At some point, I don't think they will.
I'm gonna bifurcate this and say some of the Republicans are full of shit. Some of the Republicans actually care about the debt. And the ones who really do care about the debt, I think, have a very good point, because we're going to have to deal with this debt crisis sooner or later. I'm working on a national debt episode on the political orphanage, and we're probably going to be okay for the next 20 years. But 20 years from now, the debt's going to be 200% of GDP, which is unsustainable. We can't do that indefinitely. At that point, we are really going to have the shit hit the fan where we can't deficit spend anymore. And you're going to have either massive inflation or you're going to gut Social Security. Take all the troops home. You're still going to have to gut Social Security. So we have to deal with it. It's much, much better to deal with it now than it is to deal with it 20 years from now, because it'll be a lot more expensive and a lot more difficult 20 years from now.
100%.
Right. So noting that, like, there is a good argument to be made that we have to curtail spending or raise taxes or some combination of both. I don't think you're going to get through this without doing both. I think if we were to flip it, and we were to kind of do an alternate universe model of what this would look like if the power was inverted, let's imagine that Rand Paul is president, Mitch McConnell is the leader of the Senate, and that, I guess, AOC is the
Speaker
of the House. And AOC says, we've got to get this debt in place. This is going to ruin the country. It's going to crowd out spending. We in the House are not going to consent to the budget unless you raise taxes. That's the fiscally prudent thing to do. She would have a point under that circumstance as well. It would just be that the Republicans tend to prefer spending cuts, whereas the Democrats tend to prefer increases in taxes.
The thing is that this isn't about policy. There is a budget process. There's an appropriations process. That is where this discussion needs to be had. This debt ceiling thing, this brinksmanship, this hostage taking of our ability to pay our bills, that is the problem here. You're absolutely right that we need to do something about the debt. We probably have to raise taxes and cut spending. There's no disagreement on that whatsoever. But the idea that they're going to hold our country hostage and possibly default on our debt, make us pay far higher interest rates, all that stuff, there's nothing fiscally responsible about what they're doing right now. And I think that needs to be made crystal clear. Every single year, there is an appropriations process. They have not presented their budget in that appropriations process, and it's already late. So even there, like, they're not being serious about the debt if they are not doing their annual job. And so I'm looking at these two things happening simultaneously, where they're manufacturing a crisis on one hand and not doing their budgeting job on the other. So I mean, what I think should happen is the debt ceiling should no longer exist, but they like this crisis manufacturing because they can force things through that they couldn't otherwise. This is all about crisis manufacturing. And I think it's a dangerous, horrible way to do governing. And I think we need to be more angry about the process here and focus less on the policy, actually, because even if they're right about the debt, this is not the way you do it.
Isn't this the same genre of conversation that we have with like packing the court or something like that, where it's the system that we have now is broken, so we need to change the rules of the system?
I'd say that if we're talking about the 14th Amendment and that strategy, then yes, I'd say that's the same kind of thing. Like it's the system isn't working. How can we bypass the system on a technicality rather than reform it?
Yeah.
And yes, I think that that's correct. Yeah.
But at the same time, we have to pay our bills. So it's like.
You do. And Jen, I think you're right about that. The original logic behind the debt ceiling, the debt ceiling was put in place in 1917. And the idea was that it was going to force Congress to have to think about its spending. And it was going to have a kind of a depressive effect on spending in order to keep it within X percent of the GDP, which made sense. That's a good rationale. I don't think it's played out, at least not in the last 10 years, 20 years. The debt ceiling really just becomes an opportunity to fuck with our credit rating and not an opportunity to actually fix anything. Repeal the debt ceiling. I think that repeal the debt ceiling and fix the debt would be my dual take on this. And then I would add to this that the way to do this is neither by flirting with a national default without a realistic solution, or by trying to bypass the system and have the president take on one more power at the expense of Congress through a technicality.
But okay, so here's the question. If we're not going to do this 14th Amendment thing, like if we know at this point that the Republican Party has gone all in on being this irresponsible with their governing powers in Congress, and they're not going to raise the debt ceiling without, you know, whatever craziness they're asking for, do you not think that it's appropriate for the executive branch to do whatever it can to pay the bills, even if it does lead to like...
No, I don't.
But then, so you just want us to default?
Well, okay, here's how I see this playing out. Let's say that we accept this legal reasoning. The president has a constitutional obligation to safeguard the national debt, which must be indisputably paid, and he can bypass Congress in terms...
Shall not be questioned.
Yes, right.
Shall not.
Now, President Rand is in office. Congress is not approaching a national debt ceiling. It is going to do the same thing. President Rand just starts cutting spending at his own discretion.
No. Let's deal with our actual reality, because this is happening in a month. President Biden.
Right, but you're going to set a precedent, though. You're going to set a precedent that the president has the ability to pick and choose what actions they're going to do in terms of the budget, in terms of the spending.
There is no good that comes out of this unless we're getting rid of the debt ceiling. So we just kind of have to put that aside. Do we allow the Republicans to bring their brinksmanship to the point that we default, or do we want President Biden to try to do whatever he can come up with to avoid a default? I mean, that's really our questions here. Whatever precedent it sets, do we want to allow a default in mid-June, or should Biden do whatever he can come up with to prevent that from happening?
I would say if there is a chance that we can still figure out a way to do this by giving the Republicans some amount of stuff, because they do control one of the houses of Congress, that is more to my liking than giving the president a new discretionary power over the budget process. And I see what would happen to that. Again, I think 4 years from now, you'd find that President Trump.
Hold on. This isn't the budget. Hold on. You're right that we shouldn't give any new powers in the budget process. This is not the budget process. This has nothing to do with the budget process. This is paying our bills. This should be on autopilot. So it's like.
Right. And I, the president, I'm not going to pay the bills, because we're establishing that the debt cannot be questioned, and I can take extrajudicial measures in order to pay off the debt. I'm going to cut spending. I think that there's going to be the president isn't just going to do it this one time. If this becomes a power, this is going to become a new power that Republicans can exercise in terms of cutting spending, or in terms of cutting taxes. Because I'm going to cut the taxes in order to grow the economy to fix the debt.
This doesn't in any way empower him to cut anything or to tax anymore. This would simply be the debt ceiling doesn't matter. We're paying the bills no matter what.
That is what this interpretation literally means, the president is saying that it would be a wider definition by somebody else. But if you are saying this thing that has not been referred to in the past, right? So A, you're going to have to clear the legal hurdle of the fact that, okay, well, now you can do this. Then why have presidents negotiated with Congress on the debt ceiling that they didn't believe was a thing? And now you are saying is not a thing. What Heaton is saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that should that be established and should that be protected, right? Let's say it survives in court, that also sets up the precedent that the president, that the executive branch could have then argued that they have wider control over the entire budget.
To clarify, so if we were to do this 14th Amendment maneuver, the president would have the ability to spend in order, spending that bypasses Congress. He could spend without authorization of Congress. That is the new precedent that's set there. And in doing so, to try to service the debt.
No, there's a difference between the budget process and spending and paying the bills. They are not the same thing.
Congress has not authorized, it's not authorized spending to cover the debt.
I mean, this is where we come back to, is the debt ceiling constitutional to begin with? Maybe we need a constitutional crisis here. Maybe that's exactly what this calls for, because if the debt shall not be questioned and the debt ceiling is what questions the debt, maybe this is exactly what we need.
I would much rather have the courts, if they were going to step into this, which I think is a horrible last resort, I would much rather them define the debt ceiling itself as unconstitutional than to give the president a wider latitude to bypass congressional will and congressional spending, because this is literally what it would be. Congress has not authorized spending to cover the debt. The president can spend despite Congress's will. I don't want to have that.
This is not an appropriations project. There's no, spending is appropriations. Like, basically all that we're asking them to do is to continue doing what Janet Yellen has been doing every month forever, is just continue to.
We're not in disagreement that the debt ceiling is a bad idea. I'm in agreement with you there. What I'm saying is, I think that if the way we handle this is to try to technicality our way through the 14th Amendment to give the president a new power to bypass Congress, I think it's going to bite people in the ass later on.
What happened to the trillion-dollar coin? That was the last crackpot idea.
I know. I still think that one's funny. I think the fact that we have to play any kind of games at all to get around the Republicans using the debt ceiling as a gambling chip is the problem. Like, the way this should be handled is that Republicans stop it. But if they don't, and the result is a default, I think Biden should have, like, he has to try something. So even if it means that this goes to court and we pay our bills in the meantime, that still buys us more time. Like, I just don't know what he's supposed to do other than default or give in to these people, knowing that the last time we gave in, this has led to more debt ceiling manufactured crisis. Like, when does it stop? Because even the bill that they put into the Senate just kicks the debt ceiling to the latest March of 2024. So we do this all again next year.
It's not all that further. And they're not kicking it past the election cycle, which, by the way, is the other element politically for the Republicans, is it's kind of a no lose situation. Either they bend Biden over and he gives them things that he was not otherwise going to do, or he's the president that defaulted on the debt. And it shows the Democrats are reckless financial ding dongs.
Yeah, where I think the blame needs to be placed on the Republicans where it belongs. And at some point, it needs to be crystal clear to them that they lose in this. And so far, every time they do this, they win. So there's a precedent in that, too.
Well, but let me ask you this. So you said, and I was unaware about the history of the debt ceiling, that it was put in place so there would be a moment of consideration from Congress on their spending.
That's my presumption. I mean, it was also on the eve of World War I, so it might have had to do with the war. But the debt ceiling logic, as I understand it, is we are going to force Congress to review its spending choices in the hopes that they are tethered to reality.
Could one make an argument that that is exactly what's happening right now?
You could, but I don't see any efficacious benefit from it. Our debt to GDP ratio has been getting worse and worse since 2007.
And look, I'm with Jen. Jen has made her point that regardless of the words that come out of Republicans, the congressional Republicans' mouth right now, they don't care that they are lying. If they were telling the truth, they would do different things. She is looking at deeds, not words, in terms of their care for the the debt. But that being said, if we were just looking at this in a vacuum, and the price for raising the debt ceiling is by gutting not, you know, long-term issues, but really just a lot of the priorities that came through the Congress 6 months ago, is that not a looking at spending at this moment for paying the nation's debt? Is that not the point of this mechanism?
I think we're, we as a family are sitting down and looking at our checkbook and then going, oh fuck, let's drink some vodka. So we're looking at it, but we're not doing anything. I don't think that it's having, like, it is forcing us to think about the debt to some extent, but not to the extent that we're doing anything about it.
Yes.
Unless you accept the premise that the House Republicans actually care about that and they're trying to get the fiscal house in order. And I would say some of them do and some of them don't give a shit.
Well, we will have to see, won't we? We'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Again, we'renotwrongpod@gmail.com. Money Drunken in Love writes, government banks who are controlled, regulated, and protected from failure by the government are driven to create loans to back up the government-controlled money system. We should implement separation of money, banks, and the state to make them being greedy less safe and introduce some sobriety back into the economy.
Hey, I like the sound of that. I think having banks and government be separate institutions makes sense. And my understanding is the most regulated, like basically banking and healthcare are the most regulated parts of America. And then banking, we've got a recent track record of bailing banks out, which leads to moral hazard, et cetera, et cetera. So rhetorically, I'm in agreement with you. Banks and government should be separate.
Jen?
I think we should have a choice. We can have private banks and public banks, and we can pick whichever one we want. But right now, those of us who would trust government more than for-profit bankers, we don't have that option. So I think we could live in a world where both exist.
And I'm 1,000% in favor of that, so long as no one has to actually pay for that public bank out of taxes and it's a self-funding mechanism.
Yeah, and seems easy enough.
Rates Explainer writes, Fannie and Freddie obviously set rates based on the risk of you defaulting and the expected losses. But if a borrower puts less than 20%, they are required to purchase mortgage insurance, which would cover some of the losses. Hence, you look safer to Fannie Mae. I will say that when we bought this house, because of various different weird things, we wound up having to buy mortgage insurance because our plan to put down 20% did not come to fruition. It's up to the insurance companies to properly price the risk based on the borrower's income and credit score. Prior to these changes, something of a loophole existed where if a borrower to put down 20%, any great broker would run the numbers on the borrower putting 19% down at closing, getting the rate discount, then paying the extra 1% after closing and canceling the mortgage insurance, only having paid a small insurance premium.
That sounds right.
Yeah,
that's you can pass incentives. You can't pass intent.
Yep.
The only sane emailer writes, if aliens invaded and killed all of our leaders and took over our government, would you be scared or think, quote, well, they can't be any worse than what we're used to? Jen.
I mean, at this point, I'm on team alien. It just keeps getting worse in this Congress. So, yeah, let's give them a chance.
Heaton.
I'd be terrified. And like, for the record, I think I would be a great like human foreman. I think if the aliens came down, I would Vichy regime so hard, so quick. I'd go there and be like, listen, I think you guys are doing a great job. And I speak human. I can relate to the humans, but also I really relate to you. So you noting that I would probably be part of the Vichy regime. No, I'd be terrified of it. If the aliens came all the way here and killed all of our leaders, it would indicate that they're not going to be just doing nice things like fixing our debt, and protecting the environment.
Yeah.
There would seem to be. However, on a positive note,
they'd be farming us like livestock. Like there's, it's not like, oh man, like this debt ceiling thing is setting a bad precedent. Yeah. And all of a sudden Xenu comes down and starts milking everybody. Yep. Like, no, I'm sorry. We're going to fight back against it. And hopefully Marjorie Taylor Greene and AOC have a Legolas and Gimli moment. Yes. As they both go to their deaths.
On the upshot though, there's not a good economic reason to invade Earth. Like when you watch Independence Day, the point at which you can build a giant spaceship that traverses half the galaxy, you don't really need to go to a planet. You can just do whatever you want. So unlikely we'll ever be invaded for economic purposes.
I'm just really cynical about the debt ceiling and sick of this Congress, and I want them to go away. I would probably also be afraid of the aliens.
Hey, Jen, have you heard of a book called The Three-Body Problem?
No.
It came out maybe 6 years ago. It's it's a Chinese science fiction writer that won the Hugo, and this group realizes that they find a SETI signal, and the planet that is sending this signal out, they have this horribly erratic sun that just ruins crops randomly, and they never know when it's going to happen. And they're desperately looking for some planet to invade and colonize that has a standard orbit. And one of the people from Earth calls them and goes, "Our leaders are horrible. Here's our coordinates. We invite you to come take us over and run our planet in a better way." And not surprisingly, it bites them in the ass. Traitor.
Makes sense.
Bavarian Beer Man writes, "What I found most confusing in your discussion was Heaton labeling Stella Artois, amongst others, as a super fucking elitist beer. As someone who spends a significant amount of time in the United Kingdom, I would have expected him to know that Stella's nickname is Wife Beater, which came as a result of Stella positioning itself as the cheapest beer for heavy drinkers in the UK during the 90s.
That is completely correct. It is called the Wife Beater beer in Scotland and throughout England. However, if you were in Oklahoma, I can tell you Stella Artois is a super elitist beer. You don't pronounce the S at the fucking end of it. It comes in a chalice. It's very elitist in Oklahoma, in the country that we're discussing right now.
Yeah, they have a little knife where they like slide off the head. That's another Stella thing. No, yeah, it's weird. There are some drinking traditions, as close as we are to Europe and specifically the UK in our drinking culture. And the more I've traveled, the more I've realized that American drinking culture is really this very weird mix of pub culture in England and beer hall drinking in Germany. Like that's generally like what our combined element of it is. But some things don't translate. Like cider in America is kind of, if I might be a gender reductionist, a girl's drink. Like in the UK, it is for soccer hooligans.
You get a Strongbow. You get some fucked up on Strongbow and then beat up some dudes drinking Stella.
Look, it runs at the same test in the same way that like if you're at a function for fancy people where everybody's wearing suits, it is not shocking that there are Stellas that are being poured for all your guests that are being brought around. But as you mentioned, in the UK, it's just for louts that wind up punching their spouse.
I've also been in pubs in the UK where they'll be like, "Oh, you're American. You have Bud Light here if you like it." And I'm like, no, why the fuck would I come to Britain and drink it? But like, there are dudes drinking Bud Lights because it's an import beer. Like, I've seen that before, where Bud Light was the import beer from the United States. And I'm like, the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. We still have, you know, there's still more culture that we can bridge. Conservative elitist beer writes, Duvel is the conservative elitist beer. It's Belgian, not typically obscure, but still overlooked for inferior IPAs. You can taste the exhaustion with modern liberalism contextualized by discourses on Italian elite theory in every delicious drop.
Justin, what percentage of email this week was just about beer?
There was a fair amount. We did
80% of it was about beer.
We did very specifically ask for the conservative elitist position on beer because we wanted to get that. That was 2 weeks ago. But I am thrilled that we might be the only political podcast getting this amount of email on beer that doesn't mention Bud Light. Another conservative elitist writes, "My beer of choice is Goose Island 312. And still another conservative elitist writes, "I will tell you this. If IPAs have been claimed by the libs, then the conservatives need to claim Belgians. Golden, doubles, triples, quads, all of them more delicious than the last. Duvel Chimay, Unibrew, and St. Bernard's are just a few brands that are distributed nationally. The Germans may think that they invented beer, but the Belgians perfected it." And I can just imagine that last email coming from the voice of Connor Roy's political advisor on Succession, which made it the conservative elitist voice that I wanted to read for you guys.
Delighted and honored that our conservatives are also elitists.
Didn't Anheuser-Busch get purchased by a Belgian company?
InBev.
InBev, yeah. InBev owns everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like even Bud Light is Belgian at this
there, there's,
point.
There are like really the only like this was a I did you know that I'm a fellow at a think tank? Has this ever come up? I'm a fellow at the R Street Institute. And I was given
what
that fellowship.
Whoever wanted to be on a first date with Andrew Heaton, that's his opener.
The reason that they made me a fellow was that InBev was purchasing, I think it was Anheuser-Busch. I think that was the relevant sale. And so there were a bunch of articles freaking out about how a bunch of goddamn Europeans were going to buy our beer. And so I wrote this really pithy article, mostly saying, don't worry, they probably won't improve it. It'll be just as terrible as it always was. And then bringing up like, Coors, the Rocky Mountain beer is owned by a Canadian company. Like there's very few large beer companies that are actually American. And it's been that way for a while. Really the only like American beer you can purchase is probably the craft brew from your local town. And even then, who gives a shit? Being an American, you get to drink whatever you want from wherever you want in the world.
Exactly.
No one gets to tell you who you could buy shit from. America. Yes. That's why I drink my wife beater Stella Artois.
In a chalice.
It's also why you don't have a wife.
Bit below the belt there, Jen.
Sorry.
Remember
you
that?
Set me up too
three
good.
To 5 years.
It's, oh my God. Well, at least we evened up the gender violence. Yeah, I have to say, and to anybody listening around the world, having traveled around, like, nobody can really touch America in terms of beer choice. Mm. Like we're really, really, really far past anywhere else on the planet.
You know what? I'm going to get real Bernie Sanders for a second and say that we have a diversity of choices, but not high quality. Like, I think if you go to like the Czech Republic, someplace like that, like fewer beers, but better beers, you can get Pilsner or Kel anywhere you want in the Czech Republic. I'd take that.
Okay. Cause you like, but you can get
I'm
Pilsner,
a Pilsner man.
You can get Pilsner or Kel here.
Good
yeah, go to the Yard House. You can get like anything you want.
You know, literally the one that you said you wanted. It's probably available on like six taps in this city.
That's probably true. And it's also, it's just some weird like hipster Pilsner or whatever. Okay, that's fine. Whatever, whatever.
You can go to Specs. You can get Pilsner or Cal. We can leave my house and walk
Cronenberg,
there.
My other favorite beer. Can I get that?
Yeah, okay. BevMo.
You've not said a beer that I have not heard
of. I take back what I said. A market economy is unvanquished. The greatest economy
God
in the world.
It. He tricked me, Briny. Credit score explainer writes, your credit score is an attempt to quantify how reliable you are at paying back your debts. I used to think, like Jen said, that it was silly that a person who carries debt would have a better credit score than somebody who has no debt. But if you think about what a credit score is, it becomes less mysterious. Someone who doesn't have any debt isn't reliable at paying back their debts. They're just an unknown. You have to have a good record, not no record at all.
I totally agree with that. The thing is that once you like, it's not that I have no debt. I have multiple credit cards and I have since it's been 25 years. So I've had debt that I've paid off for 25 years. And yet because I don't have more debt, like I think at a certain point, like if you have no debt whatsoever, then you should probably have a lower credit score for precisely that reason. But when you've been paying off your debts, which you still have, for 25 straight years, like I do think that.
But wait, you don't have a low credit score, do you?
No, I have a high one, but I can't get into the highest category because like I had my identity stolen in 2016. So I've been paying for Experian ever since. And I check it all the time and it tells you what you need to do to get your credit score to go higher. And for me, they want me to take out a car or a home loan. And I just, that's ridiculous. I won't do that. So it's, I understand his point. It's a good one, but it's not my situation or the situation for a lot of other people. Like I do have credit cards.
It actually is. But the difference is that you have paid small debts. What they want is for you to prove that you could pay big debts.
Huge one.
And that would be the highest level is your ability to borrow a huge sum of money. And to do that, they want to see that you can pay off a gigantic amount of
money. So it was good for me to buy my Ford Explorer.
To buy it outright?
Well, no, to finance it.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was good for you. Yes.
Oh, nice. Good job, Heaton.
A emailer wrote in saying that the presidential debates that we were talking about in our live show should be done via podcast and then asked us a number of questions. And I will ask the most interesting to me. If we were charged by the federal government to host a political debate on this show, are there any politicians that we would not platform? If so, why?
I hate that word, platforming.
Yeah, I hate it too.
Like, I just, the whole concept is ridiculous to me. Like, no, of course, if you're running for president and you've qualified, like, you should be heard. I hate this whole idea of platforming. And like, if we talk to someone, we're doing something wrong.
Like, so what would our limit be? Like, how much would you have to pull at? How much would you have to?
I would set it at, if you could theoretically win a sufficient amount of electoral votes, you ought to be on the stage.
So how do we quantify that?
If you let's take the Green Party. The Green Party last election had what? 42 out of the 50 states they were on the ballot, 37. I can't remember the exact number. It wasn't all. The Libertarians were in every state. The Greens were not.
It was at least 85%. I remember
right,
that.
But the Greens theoretically, it would never have happened. Clearly it didn't happen. But the Greens theoretically, if they'd taken all the states that they were on the ballot in, they would have won the presidency.
Yeah.
So there was an electoral path forward for them, however unlikely. For me, that would be the threshold. Would be if you're with the Minnesota Blood and Soil Party and you're only in Minnesota and there's no way that you're ever going to then no, you might be interesting, you might be worth interviewing in some other capacity, but you shouldn't be on that stage. If there is an electoral path forward to victory, I think that you could be on that stage.
I agree with that completely.
Which is going to be 4 to 5 candidates.
Okay. So for us, if we are setting our own standards, we are quantifying that by ballot access,
yeah,
and not polling.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So if you can get on the ballot, mm-hmm. then you should be on our podcast, and we don't care if one of those people is Hitler McBlood and Soil.
If Hitler McBlood and Soil can get on 38 state ballots, I would like to know what the fuck he's going to say.
Yeah.
I would like to know what the bad people are like here a few years
he's
ago.
He's mostly into zoning.
He's
weirdly
no fucking shit. He wants to tell other people what to do with their private property and yeah, make
mostly,
everything.
He's mostly. Yeah. It's a really
have
unfortunate
the government push
name.
People around and make everything more racial. Yeah. Yep. That sounds right.
It's a really weird name. Yeah. But, you know.
Yeah. I'm with you. And I think the whole platforming argument is dumb. This is, I lost a friend that I'd had for 10 years because I brought Bill Kristol on my show. To talk about, because I wanted to talk to Bill Kristol about, like, you're a neocon.
That person's a baby. Are you willing to name them publicly yet?
No, I, you know what? I still hope that we can reconcile at some point. Yeah.
Maybe tough love.
I don't want to
shame them.
Maybe
by shaming them on the podcast, that'll bring you closer together.
Justin, you're such a troublemaker.
I'm doing it for us, Jen. I'm doing it for us.
But I think
how do you think people find this podcast? Because Heaton starts his first ever public feud with somebody else in media, and eventually they go back and forth on Twitter. Andrew apologizes, and we get nothing out of it. But theoretically, I log Heaton out of his Twitter account. I rabble rouse, and we get some kind of episode.
Honestly,
it
would probably be better for my career. I can't fathom how it would hurt me, but.
You would never do it.
I wouldn't, because I have a lot more. I think the proper ratio for society is one Churchill for every 19 Mr. Rogers.
Sure.
And right now we have a bunch of fuckwits and very few Mr. Rogers and a bunch of fake Churchills, right? Yeah. I'm trying to plant myself in the Mr. Rogers camp. I think we need more Mr. Rogers in this country. I'm gonna stand by that.
Yeah.
But at the platforming thing, like a few years ago, NYU, I think it was NYU, it was either them or Columbia, brought President Ahmadinejad of Iran to come speak to them.
Yeah.
Horrible things the Iranian government was doing. You know, it's a theocracy that's literally beating women right now for the temerity to not wear a scarf the correct way and executing homosexuals. Columbia and NYU were still right, whichever one it was, to bring him over and hear. The fuck are you talking about?
You think that would happen now?
No, not now.
No. I think that was a bygone.
Because
era.
they've all accepted this platforming idea and this idea yes. that you were somehow amplifying the viewpoint. But it really drills down to two basic differences of how bad ideas should be countered. And they're not related to being left or right. They're very, very old. They go back at least to the 1600s. One is that bad ideas are countered by good ideas and openness and transparency and logic. If you have a bad idea, we want it to come to the public debate so that it can be smacked down for the stupid idea it is, and smarter heads will prevail. The other way of approaching bad ideas is that bad ideas are a virus that is going to spread and metastasize, and it must be lanced and stopped immediately. And the way to deal with bad ideas is to suppress them. I think that that is illiberal, authoritarian, and deeply pessimistic, and I am very much in the former camp.
I'm with Mr. Rogers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just want to yell his name right now. I was thinking all these insults. Man, all right, whatever. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Mr. Andrew Heaton, what's up on the ORF?
Have you guys ever been talking to someone about policy and they will say X is a basic human right? Yes. Housing, Medicare, yes. medical attention,
yes.
whatever the thing
yes,
is.
Yes, yes, yes.
I started thinking about that and I was like, the hell does that mean? Does human right actually have any meaning, or does it just mean a thing I feel very strongly about? And so I called up a human rights expert at Harvard who's a professor of law that specializes in human rights. And I spent an hour talking to him about what human rights actually mean in terms of the treaties that we've signed, in terms of the philosophical underlying nature to them, like just going past this is a rhetorical tool to what human rights actually is. That's on the Political Orphanage this week.
Legally and politically.
Legally, politically, and philosophically.
And philosophically, what are human rights? That's a very, very good conversation. Jen, I know that you've been mostly setting, spiking, and serving your way through Mexico, but do you have anything on the menu for your podcast, The Congressional Dish?
So I'm not releasing anything new this weekend, but I would suggest that if anyone wants to see why this debt ceiling thing is going the way it's going, I was covering this in 2012 when this happened the first time and every time since. I suggest going to congressionaldish.com, go to the search bar, type in debt ceiling, and listen to all my episodes about what happened in the past. I think it'd be a fun little lesson to remember, you know, how this was resolved the last time, why the Republicans think that they can get away with this again. It'll be a fun little history lesson while I get myself back to the States and back to work. But yeah, nothing we're seeing now is new. And it's all documented on congressionaldish.com.
Look at that. On PX3, I have no idea. Honestly, I have to write and record an episode like right after we're done with this, but I'm sure it'll be great. It's probably going to be about...
I have a good feeling.
Probably going to be about, I don't know, the primary. Oh, I know. Whether or not what it will take for the Joe Biden coronation to become a contest. There's one very bad poll that came out on Sunday that had all the little vultures' heads popping up just a little bit. And so I want to just walk through the idea of whether or not right now Joe Biden is being primaried, because there is a distinction, a philosophical distinction that is happening within the Democratic Party. You would think Marianne Williamson and RFK Jr., they are announced candidates. They are Democrats. They are polling, in RFK Jr.'s case, at over 10%. That would seem like somebody being primaried, but it is not. What is that distinction? I will write, record, and explain to you on Wednesday's episode of Politics, Politics, Politics.
Nice.
But that wraps it up for us here on this show. For Jen Briney and Andrew Eaton, I'm Justin Robert Young. We're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.